Hisham, when the Intifada broke out, I know you were here in the States, and I know one of your immediate reactions was you want to finish your PhD and go home. But give me your political analysis at the time. What did you, not just as a Palestinian, but as a political scientist, what did you expect this to lead to? What were you hopeful it would lead to, and what did you expect it to lead to?
Well, certainly, I think any Palestinian was hopeful that the Intifada would achieve, you know, Palestinian independence, that Palestinians would be granted or would exercise their right to self-determination in an independent, free Palestinian state. And I believe Palestinians who were involved in the Intifada had this objective in mind. And this is perhaps why Palestinians from all walks of life, teachers, unionists, farmers, doctors, engineers, I mean, what have you, everybody participated one way or another in the uprising. Shopkeepers, you know, held protest strikes against the occupation. I mean, everybody participated in their own way in seeing to it that the Intifada goes on until it achieves its objective of having an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem, i.e., the Palestinian Intifada underscored the notion of the two-state solution, and as a matter of fact, more than any other event in the past, had put that two-state solution option on the political agenda for the whole world to work on. In other words, without belaboring the point, the Palestinian Intifada, from a political, analytical point of view, really was an opportune moment for the international community to see to it that the two-state solution idea is concretized, is put into effect, is translated into concrete action. Well, regrettably, this is not what happened. While the Palestinians, on the one hand, were going in this direction, other players were going in an entirely opposite direction. The Israeli occupation intensified its crackdown on Palestinians. I can think of no single Palestinian family that was not affected, whether in terms of arrest, injury, or killing. The curfews imposed on the occupied territories certainly abnormalized Palestinian life. There were more days of curfew imposed on Palestinian cities, villages, and refugee camps than those days where there was no curfew. And I can tell you, Mark, from personal experience, that to be under curfew is the most devastating thing. A Palestinian wouldn't be allowed to look outside of his window. I mean, more than once, my late mother was almost killed. As a matter of fact, she just looked outside the window just to see what was going on, you know, in the vicinity of our house in Dehesha.
And you experienced it, you and your people, for days and weeks at a time. I remember being in Dehesha, experiencing it only for a number of hours, and having just to sit there and not look out the window and wait for the loudspeakers. And even for hours, it was quite something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and when I say, you know, that really curfews have normalized Palestinian life, I really mean exactly what I say. But at any rate, so the Israelis intensified their killing, their crackdown, their oppression on Palestinians in occupied territories. They went out of their way to break the will of the Palestinians. Rabin's policy, Rabin was the Israeli defense minister, to break the limbs and the bones of the Palestinians, basically to crush their morale, to deter them from continuing in the uprising, was used, and was used heavily. But of course, it did not achieve that objective. The Israeli occupation even went outside of the occupied territories, all the way to Tunis, to kill the second man in the PLO, Khalil al-Wazir, Abu Jihad, only a few months after the Intifada had started. in an attempt to destroy the symbolism of Palestinian nationalism. Abu Jihad was viewed as really the PLO engineer, if you will, or architect, if you will, of the Intifada after it had started.
That's right, I remember, and he was the key contact person, and a few years later, I think it was in 90 or 91, I was invited by the PLO, and I went to Tunis and met with Arafat and Shaath and others. But I would add one more thing. You've said it, but from my Washington perspective and Jewish perspective, I would add even more. I would say the Israelis saw this rebellion. They knew there'd been rebellions in the 20s and in the 30s and in the 40s. Now they saw this rebellion that had gotten a name and that had gotten world attention. And they, even though talking a different language, decided, we don't have enough checkpoints. We don't have enough restrictions. We don't have enough roadblocks. It's important that people appreciate that when the idea of a Palestinian state got going, and back in the days of the first Intifada, people who lived in Bethlehem and Ramallah could come to Jerusalem for the evening. We could all have dinner on Zaharia Street, not Zaharia Street, Salat ad-Din Street. And there were the apartheid roads, the wall, the inability to go from place to place, the blockage of almost all Palestinians from going to Jerusalem. None of that existed at the time that the first Intifada began. And I think the Israelis said to themselves, we got to make sure, with so many restrictions, so many settlers, so much taking of land, so many restrictions, that no matter what the world says, there's never going to be an independent Palestinian state here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the foremost objective of the Israeli occupation was to derail Palestinian attempts to establish an independent Palestinian state, and secondly, to make Palestinians feel and believe that their struggle is in vain, that their resistance to the occupation has even brought them more calamity and more hardship through the erection of checkpoints, through the confiscation of more land, through the inhabiting of more settlers, through the tightening of the economic grip on Palestinians. So certainly the occupation regime did everything it could to make Palestinians feel and believe that the Intifada was the wrong choice. But, you know, the Intifada, given the fact that it was a popular movement, it was a people's movement, went on unabated simply because the ingredients for its continuation were there. That is, the occupation, oppression, repression, and deprivation of Palestinian freedom all served as ingredients for a continuation of the Intifada.
And what you're saying helps explain that the PLO in exile felt it had to respond to these popular pressures, and so the historic PNC meeting, I believe it was in Algiers, in what month in 88? Do I have the timing right?
In November 1988, that's correct.
A year after the Intifada began, less than a year, the historic PNC meeting took place, and that's when, in fact, the PLO, for the first time, actually declared that we have a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. And the thinking at the time here in Washington was, well, the PLO is responding to the popular people. They don't want people in the territories to start representing the Palestinians. They want to continue representing the Palestinians. So they're going to declare a state at the Palestine National Council meeting, and this keeps them in the limelight, or am I being too cynical about it?
No. This was definitely the case. I mean, when the Intifada first broke out, I think everybody was caught by surprise. The PLO was caught by surprise. The Israeli intelligence community was caught by surprise. And, you know, people expected the Intifada, that is, many observers expected the Intifada to go on for a day, for 2 days, for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the most. But nobody, including the PLO, had expected the Intifada to become, an ongoing process. And this is when, I believe, and why Abu Jihad was very well-meaning and was widely respected, among Palestinians in the occupied territories. He really became involved, yes, he was the bridge of contact between the Intifada and its participants on the one hand and the PLO on the other. And this is why the Israelis went all the way to Tunis and, assassinated him, killed him, basically, in his house while in Tunis.
Well, we also have to put this in historical context. This was all happening just 5 or 6 years, after Sharon and the Israelis that he represented, which was a huge bloc within Israel, had attempted to destroy the PLO and kill off the PLO leaders in Beirut. They were only prevented from doing that by Reagan and his emissary Philip Habib and world public opinion. But I suspect the Israelis thought they'd done enough to destroy the PLO, that if the PLO were exiled to Tunis, they would really be out of the picture. And so this is all happening within a few years. So partly the Intifada is also a reaction to what happened in Lebanon and the attempt to destroy the PLO. Then they tried to destroy it on the ground with all the strategies that you've been talking about, what's happening to Palestinians living there. So what's your own thinking about what led up to the PNC meeting and how significant it was? Didn't it represent an ideological shift as well?
Oh, no question about it. So with the assassination of Abu Jihad in March, April 1988, the Israelis expected that the Intifada will stop, that this would be a sufficient psychological, logistical, and political shock for the Palestinians, whereby they would be frustrated enough and would stop the Intifada. But the Intifada became even stronger, and it went on. That, in my view, had compelled the PLO to take the Intifada, to view the Intifada as a more serious process than was viewed before, to consider how to capitalize on the Intifada, given the PLO relative isolation after they went into Tunis, and given the fact that the PLO had become a much weaker organization than it was before the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. The way to do so was indeed to convene the Palestine National Council meeting in Algiers on the 15th of November, where the PLO indeed was involved in a serious ideological political shift, a much clearer shift than ever before. That is, previously, the PLO had entertained the idea of a two-state solution on a number of occasions, actually all the way, since 1974, since the PLO had proposed the idea of the Palestinian National Authority program, that is, its willingness to establish a Palestinian state on any part of Palestine that would be liberated or freed from the grip of the Israeli occupation. That was really the beginning that signified the PLO's acceptance of the idea of the two-state solution, but that idea evolved since 1974 until 1988, passing through a number of statements that Arafat made, when he was even in Lebanon, under siege in 1982, and he met with a number of Congress people, members of Congress from the United States, and in statements he made in Paris, when he said that the Palestinian Charter was kaduk, i.e., null and void, leading all the way up to the 1988 Declaration of Independence that the PNC made in Algiers. To me and to many other observers, I think that was the first, most official enunciation by the PLO of its acceptance of the two-state solution idea in historic Palestine.
Was it understood as that by Palestinians around the world, not just in the occupied territories?
To a large extent, yes, it was. And I think, you know, the reaction to the PNC, Declaration of Independence, was really one of euphoria, while on the other hand, and I have talked to some people who were in Algiers at the time, in the PNC, they told me that they really had mixed feelings. They were euphoric, they were absolutely exhilarated and really rejoiced at the Declaration of Independence, because to them that really meant the beginning of real statehood. But on the other hand, they were grieving, and this is how some of them put it, over their declaration of the loss of historic Palestine, at least as far as the scope of Palestinian state is concerned. And many of those who were in Algiers at the PNC, as a matter of fact, are descendants of Palestinians who were evicted from 1948 or themselves were evicted from the 1948 Palestinian territory. So there was, yes, there was a weird mixed feeling on the part of many, many Palestinians as a result of the Algiers Declaration of Independence.
Let me tell you something I don't think we've ever talked about, but it hits me when you talked about how Arafat's statements evolved over the years. The part we have talked about is, you know, I was very close to Issam Sertawi, the PLO representative in Europe, who himself was assassinated in 1983, and at least partly because of things he was doing with the Jewish leaders, and I was working with him representing the Jewish leaders, Goldman, who was president and founder of the World Zionist Organization and the World Jewish Congress, and Pierre Mendès-France, the former president of France, and Phil Klutnik, who was president of B'nai B'rith and World Jewish Congress, and I was their person working with Issam on these matters. And what I don't think you know is that in 1985, I was asked by a congressman to go to see Arafat personally with a plea for a peace plan that included a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. And I don't have to keep it secret anymore. The congressman was Pete McCloskey, a Republican.
Yes, Pete McCloskey, that's correct, absolutely.
And he asked me to go and present his ideas to Arafat. And at the time, you know, Muna and I were together, and I told Pete I'd go as long as Muna could come and he'd take care of all the expenses. I don't know if you know this, but when Muna grew up as a little girl in Amman, Arafat used to come to their home. Her father was in the PLO. He was a very educated man with a PhD, and he worked for the Jordanian Airlines. But so she knew Arafat as a little girl. So off we went to Cairo. I don't remember what month, but it was 1985. And after a few days, we got the call at the hotel. It was around midnight, as I recall. We were about to go to sleep, but the call came, and the car showed up at 1 o'clock, and they took us. We didn't know where we're going, but the Egyptians had them at a guest house, at a very secure palace guest house. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, there, and I have the picture, you may have seen the picture, of me and Muna sitting next to Arafat. What the picture doesn't show is that the leadership of the PLO was in the room. There were 7 or 8 of the top leaders of the PLO. I presented what Pete McCloskey had told me to talk to Arafat about. There was a debate, a discussion. They, at the moment, were writing some statement that they had to give, as you were referring to all kinds of statements they were giving, and they asked for my advice and Muda's advice. So there we, you know, so I'm doing that at that time, and in a sense, maybe I was just too close to him, and so I think of it this way. But Issam was really the godfather pushing Arafat in this direction for years and years. It was Issam who reached out to the Jewish leaders. It was Issam who had a relationship with Bruno Kreisky, then the Chancellor of Austria. It was Issam who knew Dr. Goldman very well. It was Issam who knew Pierre Mendes France. I introduced Issam to Klutznik, and they became close friends. And we even went once just on a separate trip to Canada to see him because he couldn't get into the States. That was a very intense period. I was involved in the way I just described. You were involved as a Palestinian, and you've told me how immediately you started writing and speaking about these things and trying to make plans to go home. Now, what happened to your plans? In 88, you're still in the States, right?
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, I finished, you know, this is an interesting irony here, that I finished my PhD dissertation actually in November 1988, the very same month as the Declaration of Independence, you know,
right,
in the Algiers PNC meeting. So I was indeed ready to go back, and, you know, like many other Palestinians, I was partly euphoric, partly unclear about what's coming, especially, you know, the Declaration of Independence of Palestine on the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem, and as you know, the Declaration of Independence clearly said. So I was ready to go back to Palestine, and I packed up my stuff and bought a ticket. But as I said earlier, the Israeli occupation responded to the PNC and you know, announcement and to other overtures by the PLO with harsher oppression, with more crackdown, with a closure of all academic institutions of higher education. So all universities were shut down, and I became wondering, and I started wondering as to what would I do when I go back to Palestine. And my family advised me actually against going to Palestine at that time because it was quite volatile, quite dangerous. They were concerned for my life.
So for every step forward toward the two-state solution, which not only Palestinians were working for, many Americans were working for, many civil rights groups were working for, people like Issam Sertawi died for, the Israelis became more determined to make sure that was never going to happen. So they had to work even harder to crush everybody, to close everything down. You would have thought they would have responded, oh my goodness, ideologically, they've now accepted the idea that there's Israel, because who are they going to make the two-state solution with if they don't make it with Israel? But
no, absolutely. I mean, you know, looking at the whole array of Israeli occupation practices before, during, and ever since the Intifada of 1987, I mean, it became abundantly clear, I think, to almost everybody that Israeli system is not interested in any way whatsoever in the establishment of a Palestinian state, and there is so much to be said about that. So you're absolutely right. The measures the occupation undertook were absolutely meant to completely derail the possibility for establishing a Palestinian state next to Israel. So the closer the Palestinians were going towards the two-state solution, the further the Israeli system really became. So in reaction to the PNC Declaration of Independence and the enunciation of the two-state solution idea by the PLO, the Israeli occupation responded with harsher measures, with more crackdown, and I think this became quite a nebulous moment in history. So on the one hand, the PLO had given up earlier commitments to the liberation of the whole of Palestine, to the establishment of a secular democratic state in the whole of Palestine, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, the occupation decided to become more entrenched. On the third hand, I think the international community, led by the United States, especially led by the United States as the Soviet Union was, you know, about to collapse, had exploited these developments to try to appease the PLO. The U.S. ambassador in Tunis, Robert Pelletreau held talks, opened a dialogue with the PLO.
That's right. I knew Pelletreau, and he was quite a sophisticated ambassador, and he was designated to do that.
Right, exactly.
And that was one of the payoffs, I think, of the declaration of... it wasn't a declaration of a two-state solution. It was a declaration of independence, but it was ideologically understood. The PLO is now calling for a small Palestinian state. It's given up the idea of a unitary secular state.
Absolutely. So I think this was a major shift, and so the total ban on communication or dialogue or contact between the PLO, between the United States and the U.S., and between the United States and the PLO was lifted by the Reagan administration as the Bush administration was about to assume office. But, you know, as I said, this was quite a critical moment for the whole region. I mean, there were so many developments taking place simultaneously. The NC Declaration of Independence, the end of the Iran-Iraq War, the growing tensions between Iraq and Kuwait, eventually the outbreak of the Gulf crisis as Iraq, invaded Kuwait on August 2nd, 1990. The whole Middle East region was truly, had become more volatile, I think, than ever before. There are expectations, there are frustrations, and there are tensions all at the same time. So while dialogue between the PLO and the United States was opened...
Plus, we're 10 years down the road from the Camp David Agreement, from what was supposed to lead to a comprehensive settlement, but instead led to the separate Israeli-Egyptian peace and then led to the Lebanon War. And I should also mention, timing-wise, because of the Intifada, you and I have been involved in this for a long time, I decided American Jews needed to make a historical statement. And in January of 1988, just a few months after the Intifada started, actually a few weeks after the Intifada started, we published in the Nation magazine, signed by 18 of us, including Noam Chomsky and Dick Falk, who are still active today, a statement of principles declaring support for, not in such direct language, because that direct language wasn't there at the time, but it was support for the two-state solution. It was calling for a change in policy of the United States. It was calling for the United States to stop being totally one-sided in Israel's favor, and it was American Jews saying, we don't support Israeli policies. And that statement took on a life of its own. It then got signed by hundreds of people and was published in the New York Review of Books. Then it was probably published in a dozen more magazines and appeared in the Congressional Record as well. So the Intifada had ramifications of many kinds, both ideological and political. And then came what you mentioned, the Gulf War. A story unto itself about why Saddam did what he did and did the Americans encourage him to do what he did, the story of Ambassador Glaspie. But let's keep this in the context of the Palestinian issue. The Intifada, as I recall, the Intifada had just kept going, but nobody knew where it was going. Then the Gulf War comes along. The Declaration of Independence in 88 hadn't really led to anything, but I'm preempting you. Tell me what it led to.
Well, it was definitely, come to that. I mean, for sure. At that time, it had led to nothing. To nothing actual whatsoever. Actually, what happened, it was even, was even the creation of more frustration. So when the Gulf crisis broke out, by lo and behold, it was said that the PLO, Arafat, had sided with Iraq, with Saddam against Kuwait. And up until this moment, we cannot really find, you know, any statements by the PLO indicating that they were taking the side of Iraq against Kuwait. But at any rate, the PLO and Arafat were subjected to serious isolation and sanctions by, you know, the Gulf states, by the United States, and by the West. And the Soviet Union, the, you know, classic ally of the PLO, had collapsed. So it was a dire circumstance for the PLO. The dialogue they had opened, or they that had opened up for them with the United States, did not pay off. Actually, to the contrary, now they are more isolated. They are facing serious economic and political troubles. So it was a very dire circumstance. The Intifada was still going on, and I think that had created the impetus for the PLO to start really falling into one trap after the other, thinking that the way to get out of the isolation they were subjected to would be through, you know, an international conference. They were willing to go to the Madrid conference that Bush convened in October 1991 for his own reasons. And although the PLO was part and parcel of the Jordanian delegation, not of an independent Palestinian delegation, the Palestinian leadership in the PLO accepted to go. And I believe that had opened the door for opportunistic Palestinian figures, even from within the occupied territories, to jump on the bandwagon, that is, to try to search for a place for themselves.
Are you referring to the current chief negotiator who's resigned and been discredited so many times?
Mr. Averakat was one of them.
But I want to tell you where I was when the Madrid conference was announced. I was in your country. Were you still in the States at that time? And in 1991, was it?
Well, in 1991, well, I was in October of 91, I was in the States, but in the summer of 91, I was in Palestine.
Okay, let's come back to that, because it's a little moment in my life. I was sitting in Jerusalem in the offices of Al-Quds newspaper with the publisher, I believe his name was Abu Zuloff.
That's correct.
And with Saab Arakat. The three of us were sitting there, and we weren't talking about Madrid. We were talking about the peace process, and we were talking about articles and journalism, because Saab was the editor at the time. And I still remember he gets this call, and he says he has to take it. I still don't know if it was Arafat or who it was, but when he hung up, he had this big smile on his face and said, "I've just been told I will be on the delegation to the Madrid conference, and I must leave soon and get ready." His big worry was to get enough shirts cleaned. He literally talked about how he had to get his shirts cleaned. And, of course, little did I know the role he would then play subsequently in history. You, apparently, had been back that summer. Is that the first time you'd been back since the Intifada began?
No, I used to go, actually, every other year. But, I used to go every other year.
So when was the first time you went back after the Intifada started?
In 1989.
Okay. You went hoping that you would find a job, or just to visit family, or what?
Well, both. No, both. I went in the summer of 1989, in hope of really, staying there, finding a job there, and also to see family. But, of course, the situation was really gloomy over there. I mean, I was barely able to visit and, to get out of the country. And by the time I got out of the country, I think I considered myself to be really one of the lucky ones.
Now, when you say the situation was gloomy, the Intifada was still on, wasn't it?
No, it
people
was.
Were still protesting. So if they had if they had energy to protest and everything, you're talking about economically gloomy and restrictions gloomy and no jobs and everybody's
Absolutely.
Being pressured. But there was still energy, and the Intifada was still taking place.
Oh, absolutely. It was gloomy in terms of, you know, the extent of the oppression by the occupation. I mean, you know, so many curfews, so many days of curfew, so many people getting killed, so many people, you know, were getting wounded and more were getting arrested. But the energy of the people was at its peak, at its height. And people were absolutely determined. I mean, you know, and I used to walk when we had like 1 hour allowed, I mean, to walk in Bethlehem or in the Hesha during the summer of 1989. I mean, you could see the determination on the part of the people that they want to get rid of the occupation, to rid themselves of the occupation and to be free. But, of course, what happened, you know, 2 years later, really did something else.
Well, what did happen from your...
Well, the Gulf, you know, the outbreak of the Gulf crisis.
Right.
And, of course, when the Gulf War started in January 1991, you know, there were more confusions. Saddam launched Scud missiles, you know, on Kuwait. On Saudi Arabia, but he also launched some Scud missiles on Israel. And, you know, maybe these missiles were more like, you know, toy games than any, you know, thing real. But nonetheless, Palestinians thought that this could really help their cause of weakening the occupation. And what Palestinians saw at the time, as a matter of fact, was really interesting in the sense that at the moment when a Scud would be launched on an Israeli target, all Israeli soldiers and settlers would go into hiding. And that was the moment for Palestinians to come out. you know, it was incredible. So, you know, there would be curfew, let's say, you know, by the occupation, and that is nobody, no Palestinians allowed to go in and out. But then when the siren, you know, when the alarms go off, indicating that there is a Scud coming, soldiers would leave their posts and would, you know, run away, and so will settlers, leaving Palestinians, you know, for their freedom, even for, like, you know, an hour or half an hour until, you know, clearance is given for the Israelis
right.
to come out.
Well, thinking back, after the war, the Americans had decimated the Iraqis. I still remember those horrible pictures of the burned bodies and the decimation, and quote-unquote Kuwait had been liberated. But the Americans craftily knew they should get on the side of bringing peace to the region and bringing prosperity, so they... And the Arab-Israeli conflict was still there, and the Intifada was still there. And so that was the genesis, with James Baker, of the Madrid Conference. And as you rightly said, thinking back, the Palestinians reluctantly agreed there wasn't going to be a Palestinian delegation. There was going to be a Palestinian representative attached to the Jordanian delegation, which I know raised all kinds of eyebrows at the time, including mine. But Arafat wisely chose a very distinguished man who probably was a friend of yours and later became a close friend of mine, Dr. Abdul Shafi. But what was your analysis at the time when you heard, okay, there's going to be this Madrid conference with this formulation and with these arrangements? How did you see it?
Well, you know, candidly, Mark, you know, I was here in the States. I saw the Gulf War, you know, unfolding, the tenacious destruction and devastation of Iraq. You know, I was already a professor, so I was in a position to, you know, to analyze. And to be candid with you, I saw going to the Madrid conference as the beginning of the demise of the Palestinian cause.
You could see it.
Yes.
As a political scientist and a Palestinian, you could see it even then.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And
but elaborate on that.
Well, for sure, I definitely will elaborate. I was fully understanding of Arafat's need to, you know, get Palestinians out of the incredible isolation they were subjected to. That is the charge that they were taking the side of Saddam against Kuwait, to get Palestinians out of the profound frustration that, you know, that engulfed them when the Gulf War was over, when they saw the extent of destruction that befell Iraq. I mean, to them, that meant really the destruction also of, you know, some of their hopes and dreams. And to me, I think this was the beginning also of the end of the Palestinian Intifada then. So I was fully understanding of the need to get out of the isolation by Palestinians, by Arafat. But on the other hand, I also understood why Bush hastened to convene the Madrid conference. And I think I even, wrote a piece about that later on. That is, at the same year when Bush was involved in the most destructive war against Arabs and against an Arab country, he wanted to cosmetize his image in the Arab world by projecting an image to Arabs and to the world that the United States was also the country that would lead the peace in the Arab world, especially as far as the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was concerned. And Madrid was not chosen, arbitrarily. Madrid was chosen for the symbolism it has for the Arabs when they were in Spain, you know, hundreds of years before. Madrid was also chosen, I believe, strategically, you know, to signify to Arabs and to the Palestinians that this would be the beginning, the actual beginning, really, for the demise of the Palestinian cause. That is, with the almost exclusive brokership, so to speak, of the United States. The United States and the Soviets and Russia were co-sponsors of the Madrid Conference, but actually it was the United States who presided over the Madrid Conference. So this was also a drastic shift of the Palestinian cause from the international arena, from the United Nations, and, you know, to a purely American arena. That is a total hegemonic, influence by the United States over the Palestinian-Israeli conflict for many years to come. And indeed, this is exactly what happened with the subsequent Oslo agreements and the other agreements that ensued. So to me, while I was partly euphoric in reaction to the Declaration of Independence in 1988 in Algiers, I was not comfortable at all with the Madrid Conference. And to me, the country, the superpower, the power that led the war could not lead the peace at the same time, and even in the same year.
And
these
were
two diametrically paradoxical tendencies, and they did not go together.
As we talk about it, I remember in those years I was going back and forth often, and I'd be in Jerusalem, and I'd get invitations like I always gotten before to come up to Ramallah and talk to Hanan Ashrawi, and James Baker is coming, and they were getting ready for the conference. And I, too, felt there's something not right here. First of all, the terms of reference of the conference. Second of all, there isn't even a real Palestinian delegation, which reminded me of the MENA House conference after Sadat's visit to Israel. That was a long conference, might have lasted many days, and how the Egyptians had put out a flag and said there would be a Palestinian delegation at this conference. The flag was there. They were waiting for someone to come. I wondered who was going to come. I knew if Issam was alive, he'd be arguing that he should come. But in the end, the Israelis didn't have to withdraw from that conference because the Palestinians didn't show up and the flags were taken down. So I, too, without, you know, hindsight now gives us so much more perspective on it, but I remember being very uneasy. I remember saying to my Palestinian friends, I don't know what's going to come of this. The Americans need this conference, but why are you going as part of the Jordanian delegation, and what's in it for you? What do you expect to come out of it? and they were just so interested in going somewhere and having some kind of a forum. And as you say, Arafat probably, this was one of many things where he got roped into something or tricked into something or pressured into something, hoping something was going to come of it.
Yes, and I would really think, you know, that perhaps next time we should really start again here, because maybe we need to look more into, you know, this very critical period.
Agreed. That's what we should do.